The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to open our meeting of public accounts for today. And before we begin, I'd just like to remind everybody to place their phones on silent. I would like to begin with introduction of members, beginning with Mr. McGuire.
Brenda McGuire, Halifax Atlantic.
Suzanne Lonescroft, Lunenburg.
Bill Horn, Waverly, Fall River, Beaver Bank.
Stephen Goff, Sackville Beaver Bank.
Ian Rankin, Timberley Prospect.
Chuck Porter, Hans West.
Frank Corbett, Cape Breton Center.
Dave Wilson, Sackville Cobequid.
Thank you. And today we have the Auditor General visiting with us, the Deputy Auditor General. And we'll be discussing the January report of the Auditor General. And I'd like for our witnesses to please introduce themselves.
Sure. Al Horgan, Acting Auditor General.
Anne McDonald, Assistant Auditor General.
Shelley Creighton, Audit Principal.
Thank you. And Mr. Horgan, I'd like to allow you now the opportunity to begin your introduction for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, Mr. LaPointe tabled his January 2014 report on financial audits shortly before he retired in late January. A snowstorm caused a delay in the process, resulting in him being unable to meet with this committee on the day the report was presented. The search for a new Auditor General is underway. In the meantime, in my capacity as Deputy Auditor General, I will be fulfilling the role of Acting Auditor General. It is my pleasure to be here this morning to, with the help of a couple staff members, to answer any questions you may have about our January 2014 report. With me today are Anne McDonald, Assistant Auditor General, and Shelley Creighton, Audit Principal, both of whom were very instrumental in the work that is presented in this report. We will endeavour to answer any questions committee members may have.
Thank you. And we can begin our first opening round of questioning with the PC Caucus, Mr. Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to be here this morning. Thank you all for coming. We see you on a regular basis, but I know that the floor is always open to questions, at least Mr. LaPointe. I'm sure going forward we will as well, regardless of who the witnesses were. So we'll start off. It's been an interesting time, obviously. We're barely 4 months now into a new government, so my thought today was, you know, you could always come in here and I guess as opposition, it's always been something about criticisms and so on. I'm looking more for the constructive side of things and the opinion of maybe more of what's taken place over your assessments of the books and so on. So when I look at a couple of things I wanted to talk about here, you talked about the public trustee, and I'm going to bounce around a bit. I want to cover a lot of things, and time goes by quick, as we all know in this chamber, when we are asking questions. You talked about purchasing a system to account for all the assets. You had some questions around that. Has anything been done with that? What are we talking about by way of purchasing a system and the assets? Did you find something that was significant there?
We, over the last number of years in doing that audit, found that they have information sufficient to put together a set of annual financial statements, but it is very difficult based on the way the information is collected and recorded. And that's mainly because they do not have a modern computerized books of account. So we have recommended over the years that they acquire such a computer system in order to make the process of putting together the annual financial statements more straightforward and also to make our audit more timely.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. And I recall when the public trustee was here before us, there was a bit of that discussion, but things seemed to be very much looked after, but maybe in a bit of a scattered way, if that's the right language to use. I think that's sort of what I'm taking. There's no real consistent application or all in one place, if I recall. Maybe everything wasn't quite there. Was that clear? I'm just trying to remember back, and I see your partner there may want to have a comment or two.
Sure. No, I'll ask Anne if she'd like to.
Sure, thank you.
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess when we did our performance audit there at the public trustee a couple of years ago, which resulted in the public trustee being here, we certainly concluded, as we do every year during the financial audit, that there's no issue with their assets and that they are, and in fact, the performance audit, we looked at things like how they safeguarded their assets. So from an accounting perspective, every year we look at, you know, that the assets are recorded. From the performance audit, we looked at that they were safeguarded. So we have no issue with their controls around their assets. We're satisfied with those. We just feel that for an entity responsible for $45 million of estates and trusts and of vulnerable individuals in some cases, many cases, that there should be a full general ledger system that does what a general ledger system is supposed to do. And so we recommended that as a result of the performance audit. We recommended it last year after the financial audit. And again this year, in terms of process, I know that they are following up on that recommendation and taking it very seriously. I know they've done some feasibility studies of trying to adapt their own system to current system to accommodate what is needed in the general ledger system. But at the end of the day, our recommendation is simply you need to have an accounting system, and we certainly like to see it in place for April 1st, 2015.
Thank you, and I just wanted that clarity to make sure nothing really drastic had changed there, because it seemed as though we sort of understood that. And they do deal with a lot of money, and people are probably quite interested in that piece. There's a lot of families, I guess, in different accounts that they deal with. So I'll move on a little bit about tax revenue. Indicated weaknesses still exist there, and your internal controls like model input, review, and approvals are still not being done. Now, the recommendation... The department didn't believe the recommendation had merit with regards to this. Can you talk a bit about that? This was on the inconsistencies around determining tax revenues. I'm not sure how you could have an inconsistency around that, and I'm not sure what page that's on, so
yeah,
are you sure where that's at?
I'm sorry, because recommendations okay. 2.5 and 2.6, which deal with the tax revenues, they have agreed with both those recommendations.
Maybe I've misunderstood that then. That could be totally my misunderstanding how it was read, too. So that's fine. I want to talk a bit about debt, though. I want to get into that. And I'm not sure that Well, I'll put it this way. Many Nova Scotians, you know, when we think about our debt and what it costs each Nova Scotian, we see all these different breakdowns, and we hear all kinds of people talk about that from a political perspective. But from the reality of our provincial debt, can you tell me exactly what the number today is that we're carrying for provincial debt?
I guess the latest figures that we would have would be in the audited financial statements at March 31st, 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So the debt position at that point in time was net debt, so $12.8 billion. So that would be net of sinking funds that had been allocated to offset that debt.
Right. So, and we hear about this great big number, and people talk all the time, oh my, you know, gosh, what are we going to do about this debt? And when you put it into perspective, many Nova Scotians, many of us carry a mortgage on our home. We take it out for 20 or 25 years, and we have a plan. We have an end goal. We see the light that someday this will be paid off. Where's the plan provincially? There doesn't seem to be any hope when you look at this growing debt. Is there some plan that you can talk about that says there is a plan in place that one day we will actually be there?
I'm not aware of any such plan, Mr. Porter.
So that's more significant to me, and I think a lot of Nova Scotians, that will never, or there's no plan at least in place that says 25, 50 years from now that, you know, there is maybe a little light at the end of the tunnel. Maybe we do become that have province, for lack of a better term. That's probably something people understand more, that the fact that the mortgage will never be paid, than it is when you're trying to relate a certain figure. Can you talk about what it costs every day, every week, every month, or year, Nova Scotians, by way of looking after and managing and paying service fees and so on this debt?
I guess all I can speak to is the debt servicing costs that totaled $921 million for the year ended March 31st, 2013. That includes not only, of course, interest costs related to the actual borrowings, but also other interest costs. For example, on pension plans, there would be an interest cost associated with that debt, and then those probably are the two most significant aspects of the debt number, the interest cost number.
$921 million annually go a long ways towards programs and grants and so on and so forth in this province. As the people who are auditing the books here, and I mean, you're all got a financial background. Where should we be going with this? How do we bring it down? I mean, people are asking. Politicians can make all the policies that we want, and governments change and so on and so forth, but the debt remains. The debt grows over the course of time. We all try to implement programs and put funding toward things. Where is it that we have to draw the line here, or how can we tighten this up and say, you know, we have to do something? What is it?
Mr. Horgan?
Certainly. Well, it's definitely a pretty normal thing at the various levels of government to borrow, both for the purposes of acquiring capital items as well as just running the day-to-day operations. And of course, it is pretty much a policy matter that is completely up to the government of the day to decide how much of that they want to finance. My greatest concern is the risk that a high debt level may pose to the future. Ms. McDonald talked about the annual debt servicing cost, but in the future, that is very much dependent on where interest rates lie. And if there is a significant increase in interest rates in the future, that number is going to go up substantively. And that's going to impact, even to a greater extent, the programs and services that a government can offer. So I think dealing with the debt very much is, it's a present thing, but also it is preventing that future erosion of government services through higher debt service costs.
Thank you for that, and I would say this, and please take it in the spirit in which it's meant. You danced around the question very well by way of, you are the Auditor General's Office in the province of Nova Scotia. who should have a very qualified opinion about what we should be doing going forward with this kind of debt to get it under control and to reduce it, and whether that's making payments, where should we be going as financial? I look at this team as, you know, the financial guide here. If any government, I would think, would be working with the AG's office to say, okay, how can we bring this more in line? And I know you do an audit perspective, and nobody knows the numbers better than you guys. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say, or am I wrong on that?
No, we definitely have an understanding of the numbers, as would the Department of Finance. It's hard to say what the right amount of debt is for any government. I guess one means of looking at it is to compare it to other governments and see where you stand in that regard. With respect to Nova Scotia, that's exactly what we did in Chapter 5?
Chapter
4. Chapter 4. And we found Nova Scotia's level of debt to be, up amongst, I think, the second highest of all the of the jurisdictions that we compared it to. So in that regard, it is when comparing to other governments, it is a relatively high level. And thinking back onto what you said earlier, I think the key is to have a long-term plan on what you should be doing with respect to the level of debt. How is the best means of lowering a debt and lowering the risk of future, increases in debt service costs? I think any government needs to have, a very detailed, far-reaching plan to address debt levels.
Thank you. And I guess what I'm getting at here is trying to, with every new government comes new hope, if you talk to Nova Scotians, that there'll be another plan. There's promises made throughout campaigns that would instill in the minds of the voter that we're something different, we're something new, we're going to make life better for Nova Scotians. And I can't tell you how many times we hear that. We all hear it constantly. And developing programs and all those things are good. And some of them are good for Nova Scotians and do make a difference. But the long-term piece is that the debt's never going away in the minds of Nova Scotians, or at least in some. And I'm not sure that everyday hard-working Nova Scotians are sitting back wondering, okay, what are we doing in here, in this very chamber? What are we doing to make life better for Nova Scotians? And part of that has got to be part of that has got to be having a long-term plan. And I just don't know how we would ever do that with any government without the, the audits and the peace and the help from the Office of the Auditor General, who's looking at the policies. Does government come to you and we're going to develop a policy for spending in a program and say, okay, Mr. Horgan or the Auditor General or the Deputy or whoever, we want to talk about this with you and your department. Can we afford this, number one, and is this reasonable? Is there an opinion on some of that program spending now that, this committee is about looking back and we look at a lot of different things, but is there an opinion there on your part as far as policy and program development goes when it comes to cost?
I believe not. It's not something that forms part of the Auditor General Act. There is really no legislative role for us to be advising on, future expenditure plans of government and, how much should be spent where. We very much see that as a government policy matter, an area that auditors generally do not get involved in. We do annually review government's revenue estimates, but that's because it is a specific requirement of the of the Auditor General Act.
So really it's one and the same. It's the look back to say whether or not, I guess maybe we meant all the necessary goals that were outlined in programs that were designed or that we were... There we go. We're back. I guess we lost that. Sorry, Al. When we look at that second highest that you referred to a few minutes ago, when you look across the country, do we look at other provinces and say, okay, some of these provinces are doing well, and I won't go quite well because I think all the provinces are struggling through the last number of years with the economy the way it is, but there are provinces certainly doing a lot better than we are. Why? Is there that much difference in who we are?
I'll ask Ms. McDonald to address
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The provinces that we choose to look at, we do so for two reasons. One, we look at the other Atlantic provinces because of proximity, and then we look also at Saskatchewan and Manitoba because they're similar in size in terms of population. We certainly find that Saskatchewan is a province that has been doing quite well, and I think it's because of their natural resources. Newfoundland and Labrador, of course, that has their fortunes increased in recent years because of natural resources there. So those are, I guess I just also want to explain that the purpose of the chapter is really just to put the facts out there. We don't really make a lot of comments about the reasons behind things. I guess we're just generally aware of what's happening as many people are in other provinces, but we don't go into any details, I guess, and look at their, the makeup of their public accounts, their liabilities, their assets, that type of thing, to see what the nature of it is. We're just reporting ratios and comparing Nova Scotia to those.
Thank you. I guess it's really simple. And I mean, if you have revenue, things are better. There's no question about that. I mean, everybody understands that, and there are reasons why, whether it's, Alberta has the oil sands and so on. I think generally we understand that piece. But is there a ratio out there of what should be? As I know Auditor Generals and Public Accounts Committees meet annually at conferences, and I wonder, is there any discussion or is there any policy around ratios as far as where we really should be? I think we know where we are without, spending versus revenue, but where should we be? Is there something that's maybe should change there in what we carry versus what we don't or spend?
No, there's really no ratio. I mean, there are some, I guess, generally accepted ratios in the financial accounting world of, say, assets to liabilities. You want to make sure that your assets will pay your liabilities, but in terms of there being an optimum debt level or an optimum debt servicing costs, no, I'm not aware of any such ratio or number.
Thank you. I want to move on a bit here to a couple other things. Recommendations 2.8 on page 20 of the full report states the Comptroller's Office generally revenue fund and financial statements are supported and in accordance with public sector accounting standards. The department does not believe this recommendation has merit. Are you satisfied with the commitment to providing more training on how to prepare formal accounting positions? Like, will this solve the problem, or is there more that the department could be doing to ensure that the proper accounting procedures are followed?
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was a unique circumstance this year and had to do with the implementation of a fairly complex new accounting standard. We just found that some of the departments, in providing us analysis of a justification for keeping amounts deferred, and I don't know how much detail you want me to go into on that particular standard, I'm presuming not a lot, but their rationale wasn't supported to the extent that we needed it to be for the audit. And so our recommendation is just that we feel, the Comptroller's Office and Government Accounting, because they're responsible for, ultimately, the Department of Finance, for putting out the financial statements, that they should be ensuring that there's adequate support for those balances, and that if the departments are not able to provide that support, then Government Accounting, the Comptroller's Office, should be doing it as a matter of course. They don't agree with that recommendation. I think their comments relate to the size of the materiality, if you will, of the items that we had issue with. At the end of the day, we have an excellent working relationship with the Department of Finance when we are involved with the revenue estimates and with public accounts. And so we'll work with them, and they'll work with us, and we'll resolve this. They certainly came through for us this year when we needed additional information, and on a go forward, we'll address these issues as they occur.
Thank you very much. I want to talk a bit about the contaminated sites and the liability. Can you tell me what the sites are that you foresee right now that are going to be an issue or of concern?
Excuse me, Mr. Porter, your time has expired, but you will have another opportunity. We will now move to the NDP caucus, and Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I get into some of my questioning around this latest report, I'd like to touch on something that Mr. Horgan mentioned in your brief opening statements. We know the former Auditor General has just retired, and you mentioned that a search is underway for a new auditor. I know when I was first elected in 2003, I believe he came in a couple years after that, there was an all-party committee that was created to look at candidates and who would be our next auditor. So could you enlighten the committee maybe on, are you aware of what process is in place right now to replace, not that I want to replace you as acting Auditor General, but what process is in place to have a permanent auditor in place here in Nova Scotia?
Mr. Horgan.
I'm not aware of the full process. I do know that government has engaged an executive search firm, a national one, to conduct a countrywide search for candidates and to probably be involved in the interviewing and vetting of various candidates. Beyond that, I have not heard what the process will be, and I'm not aware of what the timelines are for the whole process.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm a bit concerned that your office and the acting auditor is not aware of what process is in place. I know that's not your doing, and the government needs to be held accountable. I think interesting enough that this process is not known, and we're after the fact that the former auditor has retired. So I guess I'll have questions for the government down the road. But I am concerned with that, and I would think that your office should be fully aware of what the process is to replace Mr. Lapointe. I mean, to me, that I'm quite concerned with that. So I'll move on to some questioning around this audit and this that has been brought forward. As Mr. Porter mentioned, this committee, we look back at past decisions of government to try to see where we're headed and some of the concerns we had. And I know, as coming off 4 years in government, but prior to that, 6 years in opposition, and spent a lot of time here with the Public Accounts Committee, it's an important committee to reflect on past decisions. And I think to make sure that the current government, whoever that is at the time, doesn't make those same mistakes, and that the work that your office does is extremely important. We know in 2009, when we came into government, we were facing some serious financial decisions. We had 10 years of Conservative government. We had Rodney MacDonald's government, who placed Nova Scotia in a position that if changes weren't made, that we would have a $1.4 billion deficit, structural deficit, within 4 years, which would be detrimental to services that Nova Scotians depend on. It put us in, I think, the worst economic position in about 20 years. So I know Mr. Porter talked about paying on the debt and issues and concerns around the debt. I know Mr. Lapointe has been very public on his concern with the current government and government overall trying to address the debt issue of Nova Scotia. So my first question, are you aware of any debt servicing or anything paid on the debt over the last, well, let's say, 4 years that went towards reducing that debt? And I know it may be an unfair question as the acting auditor, but we'll try that as our first question.
Mr. Horgan?
Well,
sorry, yeah. Ms. MacDonald.
I'll ask Ms. MacDonald.
Thank you. In Chapter 4 of the report, there's a chart around paragraph 4.19, which shows the direction of the debt, and it certainly has increased. In 2011, it reduced, and I believe that was because there was a surplus in that year, so that would have a direct impact on that. But in terms of other amounts, I'm not aware of anything. I believe that other than that 2011 surplus, that the net long-term debt and the net debt have increased.
And I'm aware that there could be a surplus, and that doesn't necessarily mean it goes on the debt. It has to be a decision of the government to put any surplus on the debt, and there was a payment on the debt of almost half a billion dollars, $447 million, in that 2010-2011, which at that time reduced the net debt for only the seventh time since 1951. So it's significant. And it's important. It's a small step. We have a large debt. I think every party would recognize that. But I think it shows the importance of making wise decisions. So it was a decision at the time to have when we had the surplus, to place it on the debt. So my question would be, is it important to continue to make those decisions in the future as we go forward, if there's surpluses that the government put that on the debt, so that we can reduce the servicing of that debt? We know how large it is. I think we spend over $100 million a year on servicing a debt. Maybe I'm wrong. I try to remember numbers, but it's a significant portion of our annual budget. So should government make those decisions, and should there be a plan to indicate to Nova Scotians that that's what will happen if surpluses are seen in the province in the future?
Ms. McDonald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly from a policy perspective, as Mr. Horgan indicated, it's not the role of the Auditor General's office to comment on how government spends the money. But in any situation where there's an opportunity to reduce debt and to reduce related debt servicing costs, that of course has a positive impact on, as you mentioned, debt servicing costs. So from that perspective, you know, that's certainly a good idea. I just want to also point out that in terms of a plan, while there is no long-term plan, of course, every year when the budget is presented, there is a debt aspect of it included in the budget documents that deal with the borrowing plan for the next several years and indicates, the borrowing that's required to finance the operations in any given year, and then the potential reduction in debt as a result of planned surpluses. So it is included annually in the budget documents.
Okay, thank you. And I know particularly the former auditor, I think they even created some cartoons around the auditor and the current premier on ensuring that he's aware of the issue of the debt, and it's been a challenge, and it's going to be a challenge for the current government. It has been a challenge over the last 4 years. I know it was a challenge before that, but I think what we need to ensure is that the right decisions are made as we move forward when it comes to trying to ensure that we address the debt as time permits, and we'll have to look forward to seeing what the current government has in store over the next number of years when the budget is introduced in a couple months, I would assume, or are we February or month or so. So I'd like to go to page 9 on your report, and it's really the for opening few sentences, and I'll read them and then ask you a bit of how important it is to continue that trend. So in the summary, page 9, it states the review opinion on the 2013-14 review revenue estimates was unqualified for the first time in 13 years. This is a significant improvement in government financial reporting. Government implemented recommendations made by the office and an independent consultant that the review estimates include revenue from all entities included in the consolidated financial statements as required by the general accepted accounting principles. I'd like to maybe ask you to elaborate a little bit on why an unqualified opinion or unqualified opinions are such an unusual occurrence over the last 13 years. Even throughout our mandate, it was on the last year that we were able to get unqualified opinions. So why would you feel that it took 13 years or the importance of having an unqualified opinion about the budget? And it doesn't matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any time that there's a qualified opinion, it's not a good thing. It's always great to have an unqualified opinion. Certainly, this province is unique in Canada in that we perform this review on an annual basis as required by the by our mandate in the Auditor General Act. And the issue arose because as the accounting principles change over time, and when we started the review back in the late 1990s, there wasn't a requirement that financial statements be consolidated. So at that time, they just really concentrated on the financial activity of departments. But then there was a change in accounting principles, which said, you need to bring in all of your other operations so that users have a full idea of the extent of government operations throughout entities, and also the extent of government revenues, government expenses, and government debt. So when that happened, we as a result, the revenue estimates needed to be prepared on a consolidated basis, and they were not. There were rationales as to why they weren't, including the difficulty in estimating those amounts, because they deal with outside entities, mainly school boards and hospital authorities, who get external funding from, for example, school boards get it from municipalities, district health authorities get it from the federal government for patient costs, we were just told over the years that it was difficult to estimate those amounts. Over the last couple of years, we've really highlighted this more than it perhaps had been before, to say that this needs to be done. And fortunately, last year we discussed a process with the Department of Finance staff on how to go about estimating these revenues. And it turned out to be, I think, not as difficult as was anticipated. At the end of the day, it's the revenue estimates opinion is based on a reasonability concept, and the process that was undertaken and the results certainly yielded what we would consider more than reasonable results for those entities that needed to be consolidated in the revenue estimates.
Thank you. So it is significant, I think, and it's something that I think is extremely important when you present the budget to Nova Scotians. So my question would be: should we continue to look to have an unqualified opinion on the budgets in years ahead?
For the revenue estimates, which is the only aspect of the budget that we're involved in, I certainly anticipate that there will be, with respect to that particular matter, that will go forward and will become part of the process, and there shouldn't be any issue. I can't say that there will be always unqualified opinions, because we never know what will happen, but it looks like that issue has been resolved, and we're really pleased with that result.
Thank you, and I guess we'll know in a couple months. If that trend continues, and I'm sure as public accounts meet, maybe I'll be able to ask that question in the future. So it does ask, it does bring some questions up when we see the Premier and the Finance Minister talking over the last little while when they gave the last financial update to Nova Scotians. And on December 20th, 2013, the current Premier and his Finance Minister seem to be at odds with the same numbers your office gave an unqualified opinion on. So, for example, in the Truro Daily News, the Premier was quoted saying, and I quote, "The updated finances shouldn't be a surprise because the NDP budget was too optimistic," he said. Every Nova Scotians questioned the revenue numbers that were put forward by the previous government. We all said that they were too rosy. The numbers now that have come in and that have verified confirm that. And on the same day, the finance minister, Minister Whelan, was quoted as saying she doesn't believe the New Democrats' artificially inflated projections. So here we have messaging from the government really saying two different things. And really, it's, I think, in my opinion, and in our caucus opinion, that the messaging from your office is the one that Nova Scotians should listen to. So really, I think the question is, who should we believe here? We have the Premier saying one thing. We have the Minister of Finance saying another thing. We have your office saying, here we have an unqualified opinion of the finances that were brought forward. So would you stand by that the numbers brought forward in the last budget were consistent and followed all the rules and really were a true reflection of what was anticipated in the coming year?
Ms. McDonald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, first of all, again, to highlight that we're only involved with the revenue side of the budget, and again, to highlight that the review estimates opinion is, revenue estimates opinion, rather, is dealing with the reasonability of the amounts and with the and that they reflect the underlying assumptions used. So during the course of the review last year, as in every year, we look at the process that is undertaken by the Department of Finance to present the assumptions. The assumptions are very much based on Stats Canada information. You know, they're adjusted for anticipated growth rates, which also we look at to see if the growth rate is reasonable, and we also are aware of a process, a challenge process, that the assumptions go through. The assumptions then, of course, feed into the various tax models. So, at the end of the day, I can't comment on, you know, what the average Nova Scotian or who they should believe, but I am quite confident that our opinion last year was as a result of a process, and that we were satisfied that the of the reasonableness of the revenue estimates based on those processes and the underlying assumptions.
Thank you for that answer. And you know, what I wanted to show is the fact that here in the first paragraph of your review, mentioning the fact that it's the first time in 13 years that we had an unqualified opinion of the finances of the province, and that's significant. And I think Nova Scotians will see through some of the comments made off the cuff, I think, by the Premier, for example. I would support what you just said, and I supported what the current finance minister stated in her financial update to Nova Scotians, and I hope that the Premier in the future you know, talks to the finance minister before he makes some comments. I believe I'm close to wrapping up my time.
Yes, Mr. Wilson, you have
so
1 minute.
Well, I'll leave that at that, okay. And we'll come through the second round.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. We will now move on to the Liberal Caucus and Mr. Rankin.
Thank you for allowing me to speak today. It's certainly a privilege to be in part of this committee. Being a new MLA, this topic of debt is very important to me, and as it is important to the Liberal Caucus. Actually, I think all the MLAs to the left of me are also new MLAs, and I think it's very important that we look at the future. And I'm a little surprised at the politics being spoken already about past elements of why debt has gone up. So the Rod and MacDonald government was even spoken about. But really, why is this debt here? Certainly isn't anything that this new government has done. It's to do with a lot of things, the historical profligate spending that has happened. So it is tough being a new MLA, looking at the extreme amount of debt that we do have to deal with, and it really is a balance of considerations. A lot of it has to do with expenditures, but also revenues like any business. And I think that our approach to this is a good one. We have to look at both sides. We were the only party that didn't really promise any revenue decline like some of the other parties promised a cut to HST, and some of that's worth, I think every point's worth $190 million, give or take, per annum. So it's important. I think there's a balance of considerations. I think it's a safe approach to look at each department and try to get savings. So 1% from each department except for health and education, I think, is a good plan. So what was brought up about the money put down on the debt in 2011 from the surplus, could I get a fact check on the net effect on the debt from the last 4 years of the NDP mandate? So there was money, in other words, there was money put down on the debt, but certainly there was money added to the debt in terms of capital expenditures. Do you have that number? Just to clarify, what net impact the last government had on the provincial debt?
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. I don't have that information available. I only have the last 2 years of financial statements in front of me. So I don't know exactly what the amount is that the debt increased in the last 4 years, but that information is readily available.
Okay, but could you just say that, did it increase in the last government mandate? In the last 4 years, has the net gone up?
Yes, the net debt has increased in the last 4 years.
Yeah, okay, I hear some comments because it's because the prior premier, but we can talk about politics all day. When in 1978, the debt was around $2 billion, I think even less than that, and then after the... In 1993, when the next Liberal government took place, it was over $10 billion. So I think we can talk about that all day. The question I have on the Auditor General report is I just want clarification. It's interesting because before the NDP challenged the pension valuation adjustment, and now today the NDP member says that they supported everything that the... that our financial outlook reported with our first report from the minister. So the $280.3 million pension valuation adjustment, that was a recommendation by our office. I just wanted you to briefly explain the benefits of providing that.
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lapointe provided an opinion in late November to the Department of Finance related to the accounting for the public service superannuation plan. And in that opinion, he indicated that his view was that the entire amount of the unamortized losses, and again, I'm getting into some technical terms here, that were sitting on the books of the province at March 31st, 2013, needed to be written off. My understanding is, and again, we don't look at the expense side, but in preparation of the 2013-14 budget back in February and March of 2013, there already was an awareness that there would be changes in accounting. It just wasn't known the extent of the changes. And so the budget already reflected in the pension valuation adjustment an amount for... a possible accounting treatment for those for that change in the public service superannuation plan. So at the end of the day, the $200 million change in the pension valuation adjustment is a result of a couple of things. It reflects the additional amount that came about as a result of the opinion. So in other words, you wrote off this much, you budgeted to write off this much, you actually need to write off the entire amount. So there's that difference. And then in addition to that, my understanding is that the Department of Finance, as they do every fall, they get updated information from the actuaries. And so the pension valuation in any forecast that's put out towards the end of the year would reflect the updated information from the actuaries. So that adjustment includes not only the results of the public service superannuation plan, but also other plans for which actuaries had provided updated information. So they included everything in the pension valuation adjustment.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted clarification.
Mr. Rankin, have you finished? Would you like to pass it along to one of your colleagues?
Yeah, I'm finished. Thanks.
Mr. Goff.
Thank you. I'm here on sitting in for Joachim Stronach. And my question is, regarding the inconsistency or inability with tracking pension files, has there been any evidence of a pensioner actually looking for files that the public servants are not able to retrieve?
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. So you're referring to Chapter 3 in our audit of the Public Service Superannuation Plan, in which our most significant finding was that we had we could not verify, as we hoped to do, that pension payments to the sample of pensioners we selected were accurate. Certainly, the majority of the files that we pulled related to individuals who were employed in government departments, and then the next largest group were those that were employed either with the current CDHA or with predecessor hospitals like the VG, Nova Scotia Hospital, et cetera. And so, you know, at the end of the day, we just could not find the information that we were looking for to verify that pensions paid were accurate. The information that's required is fairly minimal in terms of a person's employment history. You know, you need to know when they started. You need to know their age. You need to know when they stop working there, and you also need their last 5 years because it's the pension formula, benefit formula is based on, generally speaking, your highest 5 years of salary, and that usually is your last 5 years. So the recommendations that we put forward to both the Public Service Commission and to Capital Health were really well received, and they recognized that it was an issue and that they need some adjustments to their file retention and management policies so that that information is available should a pensioner want to request the information to verify amounts.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Goff, have you completed your time?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Horn? Or sorry, Mr. McGuire?
All right, we're skipping to me. Okay. Thank you for coming here today. It is, like Mr. Rankin said, it is an honor to sit here. And my question for you is that the report highlighted that the AG Act excludes trust funds that are subject to joint trusteeship. This means, obviously, that it can't be audited by the AG. So do you believe that this presents a risk to the plan?
Ms. McDonald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, at the end of the day, I guess the most important thing is, I guess in our view, is that there are processes for such audits to take place. So certainly both the two plans that are under joint trusteeship would be the teacher's plan and the public service superannuation plan. And both of those have you know, governance structures in place that in the acts themselves, they require annual audited financial statements, and they're also within the, you know, the operations of each of those. I speak more to the public service plan. There's requirements for quarterly and annual reporting to members. And so the recommendation that we made in here, I think, which was that at least for the public service plan, which we now are no longer able to audit with the change in governance structure as of April 1st, 2013, that the new board should ensure that the types of audits that we just conducted can still be conducted. I mean, whatever they choose to select as topic areas, but performance audit generally, as opposed to financial audits, because those are done every year, so that the you know, information on things like investment management, because that's now a key factor and totally under control of the new board, can be looked at with independent eyes and reported back to the board. So outside of management review, a process to undertake independent audits and report back to the board.
So, in your opinion, and your office's opinion, Do you believe that we need to make an amendment to the AG Act to support this?
Mr. Horgan.
I don't believe so. The Auditor General Act was overhauled only a few years ago, and at the time we were very comfortable with the mandate that it provided to us, including what we can and cannot audit. And we're in agreement with government's preference to have shared trust pension plans to be excluded from not only government control but also from the mandate of the Auditor General. So, no, we're comfortable with that.
I thank you for your answer, and I'm finished.
Thank you, Mr. McGuire. I believe, Mr. Horn, you have some questions.
Thank you. I'd like to ask a question about the seems to be the disconnect in what Stephen was talking about, the recommendations on Section 3.32. Is that very widespread in the government service about not keeping records or being able to find the records of personal government employees?
Ms. McDonald?
Thank you. We indicate in the report that we didn't do an audit of government record retention policies, so our comments really are just isolated to this audit, so I can't really, I have really no information on how widespread. Certainly in this instance, we did have considerable difficulty and we were unable to meet our audit objective. We only were able to verify one individual in a total of, four individuals and I think 51 sample items, and that's a fairly significant error rate, that 47 out of 51 we could not find. So, but I'm not aware, and we didn't audit the record retention policies of government in general.
The thought that from the employee's perspective that could be loss of information and how it might affect their pension plans and capital health and the superannuation group. I'm just wondering, you can't really tell us how widespread that was or is.
No, I mean, we conduct an audit. We select a sample. The sample is to be representative of a population of retirees. As mentioned, we had a fairly significant error rate there. So if you extend that out, I mean, it could potentially be widespread, but we really don't know. Once we start running into difficulties and realize we can't conclude our objective, we don't continue testing because it seems to be, you know, really not of much value. As I mentioned, though, our meetings with both Capital Health and with the Public Service Commission, they were very receptive and realized that this was an issue and that they had to make changes. We were very pleased with how they responded to our recommendations and so on. And my understanding is that Capital Health has already started to implement some changes. So on a go-forward basis, hopefully this situation will resolve for people as they retire. I mean, certainly can't do anything about missing records for people who are already retired, but on a go-forward, hopefully the situation will improve.
So you feel you'll follow this up in the future years of your audits?
Yes, as is our practice, in a couple of years we'll follow up this. So this was conducted in 2013, reported in early 2014, so we'll follow up in likely late 2015 and follow up on report the status of the recommendations.
Do you have any idea in other governments, other provinces, what that type of error might be and the cost to the employee or the employer?
No, I don't. I don't know what the policies of other governments, and I'm not aware of other audit offices conducting similar types of audits. They could very well have. I'm just not sure if they did, and consequently, I don't have any comment on that.
So you feel that the Public Service Commission is now providing and keeping good records more through electronics, or are they hard copy?
We didn't follow up on where they are. We made the recommendations. We spoke with Public Service Commission as we went to report on this in late January, and that's part of our normal process. But so my comments are just on their reaction to the recommendations. We haven't done any follow-up activity at this point, so I'm not sure what steps they have taken there or at Capitol Health, for that matter, to know where they are in implementing the recommendations.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Horn. Ms. Lonas-Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The report takes a look at expenses by department as percentage of total expenses. The report highlights major cost drivers such as education, community services, assistance to universities, health, and debt servicing costs. When looking at other expenses, the chart shows that other expenses have increased over the last 5 years. What departments have increased expenditures under the other expenses category over the last 5 years?
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. I don't have that information readily available. Certainly, we focus in this chapter on the larger departments because they just represent such a substantial proportion of the total expenses. That information is readily available from the public accounts. So I can see that in the public accounts, for example, labor and advanced education was actually underspent last year. So I can't give you the details of the individual departments that make up that total other right now. I don't have that information available, but it can be provided.
So there's no way of knowing if there is one department that is consistently increasing their expenses?
No, other than the departments that we choose to highlight in this chapter for information purposes, I don't have any information at the ready for individual departments aside from the four that are listed there, and of course debt servicing costs.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. McGuire.
Thank you. Regarding the comparative analysts in Chapter 4, do you believe that this analyst is fair, seeing as we're comparing Nova Scotia to resource-rich provinces?
There's a rationale, I guess, provided as to why we compare to those provinces. Again, proximity in region and proximity in size. We're not trying to, in this chapter, make any sort of qualitative comments about what's presented. It really is for information purposes and gives an idea of how it compares. But I think with background information that people have, generally speaking, about how things are in Saskatchewan or Manitoba or Newfoundland, Labrador, for that matter, New Brunswick, they can draw a conclusion as to why it might be that Nova Scotia is better or worse off than any of those other jurisdictions.
But taken at face value, there are people that may not know the different circumstances in Newfoundland and Saskatchewan, and if you just look at the document and you look at this analysis, it seems that we are lagging behind. But in fairness, like I just stated, we are comparing ourselves to some of the resource-rich provinces in Canada.
Yes, that's right. I would suggest that if people want to go beyond what's presented here at face value, that they would explore as to why Nova Scotia is better or worse off than other provinces. And, for example, in Saskatchewan, the answer will become readily apparent in terms of their resources and their lack of debt.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald. Mr. McGuire, the time has expired. We'll now move to the PC caucus for 16 minutes with Mr. Porter.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I just want to go back to, on page 23, there's a new accounting standards outlined. What sites will fall under the contaminated sites liability? That's where I left off.
Sorry, Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. I believe your question is, have they identified the sites?
Correct.
Our understanding right now is that government accounting is working with departments to identify the sites. We don't know them. So if you're asking, do we know all the sites? No, we don't. but Government Accounting is working with the departments to identify the sites. So we'll get more information on this as we conduct the audit for the year ended March 31st, 2014, in anticipation of this new standard being put in place for April 1st, 2014.
Thank you for that. The department said this wouldn't have a significant impact on the financial reporting as a result of adopting the standard itself. Is that accurate? What will this actually mean to the balance sheet of the province? Or is it too early to tell, given that you haven't been there, and appreciating your last answer? But
At this point in time, it is too early. It is early for us to comment. I think their comments are based on the standard is quite technical in terms of there has to be an environmental standard that has not been met. There has to be a plan or an obligation on the government to, in fact, be remediating the site. And so when those factors are considered, I guess government's position right now or government accounting's position is that they don't consider that there will be a big change, because right now what the province does is they do recognize a liability if they've identified a site that they intend to either sell or use themselves in the future, and they allow for that the cost of remediation. So there is already a policy in place for accounting for those liabilities. So I guess what they're meaning by their comment is that they don't anticipate that there will be that many more sites that will be impacted by the new standard. But we don't know yet for sure, as their auditors, exactly what they've identified and how the new standard relates to those identified sites.
So I'm assuming you will be looking back at those when the time comes for a more accurate accounting of that. Yeah. Okay. I want to go back to something that's already been brought up a little bit, and that was Chapter 3 with regards to these pension. Province of Nova Scotia and Capital Health do not keep adequate records to provide verification of those pension payments, and that retirees is accurate. I'm just going to look at my notes here. In paragraph 3.24, on page 34, it states, the lack of historical salary information is a serious deficiency. There was a lack of files for 47% of the sample group, and there's no requirement to verify that these files are accurate. We've talked a little bit about that. In terms of the financial risk, though, what percentage of the plan's retirees would fall into the group that has unverifiable pension payment?
So are you asking what percentage of the plan are retirees right now?
Yeah.
I think approximately half of the members. Approximately half of the members are retirees. I think there are approximately 26,000 members. I might be off on my data here, but if you look at the first of Chapter 3, page 30, it gives some information, I believe, or maybe not, on members. I don't think it does. I'm sorry. It gives information on the dollars associated with it. But my recollection is that approximately half of the members of the plan are retirees, so around 12,000.
So, and I know this is probably hard for you to answer, and as an accountant and somebody who's in your position, but the records are not there to verify. Is there an assumption then on your behalf, because of the job that you're asked to do, that there are inaccuracies there that we have to go and find? Are the pension payments, are you worried that they're not correct?
We don't have any, the information wasn't there, and because of that, we can't make a comment on whether or not they are inaccurate. Part of our testing was to see what information is in the Pension Services Corporation's PenFAC system, which is what's used to calculate the payments, or rather to provide the information to calculate the payments. And we know that the information that's used to calculate them is resulting in an accurate payment. We just don't know that the information itself is accurate, because we couldn't find the records. I guess right now it's not possible for us to make a statement on whether or not there's accuracies or inaccuracies out there. Certainly pensioners, when receiving their monthly pensions would hopefully raise flags, but I can't make a comment. I guess I just don't know. We don't know about how accurate payments are.
Would this suggest that pensioners should go back now, and if they haven't already, I guess I would just think about knowing a lot of folks who've recently gone off, there would be courses by the employer you'd go through, as you get ready for retirement and so on, and would that not all be part of that? Would that not have been covered? I would think that it would have been, but perhaps, I'm sure there's probably not 100% uptake of people retiring that go through that workshop, if you will, for lack of a better term. But I guess maybe I only think about myself. I'd want to know that things were accurate. You know, you pay in all your life to your pension, et cetera, that is there some risk there? And you've sort of outlined that there is a risk that maybe they're not accurate. Should we be talking to these groups to say perhaps you should go back and review your plans to see if things have been accurate? Are you that concerned?
I don't know that there's I guess the results are that there's any huge inaccuracy. We really don't know. You know, every year for current members, and certainly those members who are retired prior to the retiring, they are receiving a statement from what was previously the pension agency, now Pension Services Corporation, that outlines their, you know, their benefits to date and their vested pension, and, you know, provides information on their marital status and their beneficiary's start date and sort of earliest retirement date. So, you know, I'm hopeful that as current members and those retired members prior to retiring, that they would be reviewing their statements to, you know, to look for how accurate those are. I mean, I certainly think there's a shared responsibility, if you will, that
Yeah, thank you. I agree. And is there an assumption in there, maybe that the records don't verify that there would be regular reviews of these as things change? You've just outlined the statements and so on like that. Would reviews occur at that time from those managing the pensions to make sure that things are accurate, or would we not assume that at all?
The pension agency is not responsible for the accuracy of the information that goes to it. So, for example, a government department has hired somebody and sends over information on what that individual's salary is. So the Pension Services Corporation is really just inputting that information into their system. They are relying on the department to have provided the accurate information to them. So, to your point, management at Pension Services Corporation, you know, they certainly have processes to reconcile information on a monthly basis. They certainly produce these annual members' statements, but my understanding is that they wouldn't be reviewing pension payments for accuracy.
They're only going based on what's been fed to them.
That's right.
So it would come back to the government agency or the Department of Health or whomever that manages that piece. Okay. I don't have a lot of time, and it goes by quicker. I want to bounce around a bit. Of the 23% of the recommendations left from 2010, the financial report in Chapter 6, are there substantial changes that need to be made? Maybe outline some of the risks, if you can, that are still waiting for completion.
Sure. Thank you. The main recommendations that are left over from 2010 have to do with the internal controls. And, you know, that implementing recommendations on internal controls on a government-wide basis is, I think, quite difficult. I know the government has been in the last few years involved, initiated a project on trying to do just that, and they've taken some steps to look at internal controls from both a government-wide perspective and, you know, to try to drill down into particular areas such as revenues, and that's why it's designated as a work in progress. They have made some action. I can't speak to when that project will be finalized or when this recommendation will be these recommendations will be fully implemented. But we do look at it every year to see that progress has been made and evaluate it based on that.
What would your biggest concern of all the recommendations put forward that haven't been implemented yet from the report? Is there something that stands out for you all as a department of the Auditor General?
I guess with respect to financial reporting, you know, the main recommendation that we wanted to see implemented was that the revenue estimates were prepared on a consolidated basis, and that has been done. We do recognize, as I said, that internal controls take a while to do so. And really, internal controls, in terms of the last recommendations to be implemented, they would represent the majority of them. So we would like to see those implemented, but do appreciate that it will take some time.
And you certainly speak to that, taking time. How much time? I mean, the Auditor General in past has been pretty specific on some things that they want to see done and has made suggestions and referrals that, you know, should be addressed right away. What is a fair amount of time for such things? I mean, internal controls, people might say, well, what's that? You know, and maybe you want to touch on that a wee bit so people do understand about the internal controls that you're referring to, but how much time is enough before there's some action being taken? You know, significant action, you know, in making a difference that you can quantify through your audits.
Well, we certainly look to see that our recommendations are implemented after 2 years, so we'd like to see that happen, and it hasn't happened. In terms of kind of defining what internal controls are, I mean, you can be dealing with something as, you know, sort of as small, if you will, of making sure that the right people are reviewing bank reconciliations, to major things such as making sure that there's an ethical environment in government, that they're, you know, people who are in the public service are aware of our code of conduct and those types of things. So there's a huge range, and certainly falling in there is also information technology, and you're dealing with things like access rights. So there's a wide range, and every process that generates a number can go through many steps. So at the end of the day, you want to make sure that things that are reported for not just financial reporting purposes, but also for decision-making purposes, are as complete and accurate and up-to-date as they can be. And those processes, while they're not necessarily complex, they are. I think it takes time to identify what needs to be done and to put it in place. So I guess we are aware that it does take a while to do that. Again, we'd like to see it done as quickly as possible, but we appreciate that government is working on it and that it will take some time.
A lot of that, I would think, across departments would be almost a blanket policy. I could see delving down a little deeper in certain areas where maybe it's not quite so simple, but I think from, you know, an everyday Nova Scotian's perspective, this shouldn't be that hard. If you come up with a recommendation, it should be fairly easy to begin work on it and complete the task in a timely fashion, whether it's IT controls, like we've discussed many times in this chamber, that how hard can that be? I mean, technology's changing by the day. Those of us that use it know that, but it seems rather simple, you know, but some of this stuff seems to drag on, I guess, was what I was getting at. I'm getting close on my time, so I do want to jump here quickly to a final question or two, and that is around the budget. From the AG's office and perspective, should the budget be balanced? Why are you laughing, Frank?
That's a good answer.
Mr. Horgan.
That is not something that our office would have an opinion on, especially with respect to any single, you know, fiscal year. There are so many decisions involved in that, expenditures that are required to provide services and to deal with, you know, even maybe unusual circumstances. That comes along. Only government can choose whether to, at what level to make expenditures. So, it really comes down to executive government to decide in any one year whether they're going to spend more than comes in as revenues. And it's really not the role of this office to provide an opinion with respect to what those figures, you know, or the state of balance should be in any one particular year.
Thank you. I think my time is maybe up, is it?
Mr. Porter, you do have about 60 seconds, but
okay. Thank you. And as I guess
probably, if not the most significant department working for the people in this province, as the AG's office is well respected and has been and has gone through many hours of work preparing each year the statements. And I just find it odd that there isn't, you know, I understand what you said, Mr. Horgan, clearly, that governments will come in, they'll change, they'll make up their mind what they're going to put in for programs and things like that. I was just really looking for someone from an accounting perspective and knowing a few accountants, how anal they are with regards to this column and balanced budgets. I was looking for, you know, yes, we believe, although may not always possible, that we should be trying to, you know, maybe balance the books if you can. And personally, as far as I'm concerned, if there's a debt.
Sorry, your time has expired. Mr. Corbett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I only have a few questions. It won't be long. Just going back on the pension issue, Ms. McDonald, I wonder if you could tell us the files you pulled, were they, did you pull them with any kind of ideas in mind, like ones that may have been pensioned out for 20 years and had a group with maybe only a couple of years out, how did you come about with the group that you chose to audit?
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. So basically, we selected a pension pay period during 2012. We got information on who was there, the individual pensioners. We really just selected randomly, so just kind of, you know, completely randomly, and ended up with I guess at the end of the day, a representative cross-section when you consider that in any situation, most of the members are going to be, you know, former departmental employees versus our health sector. So it ended up being, a representative population, but it was selected completely at random. And we ended up with a variety of retirement dates. So we found that we took the information to the Public Service Commission and to Capital Health and said we need information on these retirees. Can you please provide their files? And in some cases, they were able to find the files, but the information was not in the files. In other cases, files were just not available. So it really didn't seem to have, there was no sort of relationship on the number of years retired and the absence of a file. We didn't see a correlation there.
So the information that was missing then, was there a predominant issue? Was there predominant, and by way of example, would we say that the hard piece of data that was missing was the years that person had paid into pension and at the rates? We know about the five-year exit, but what I'm talking about, I really don't understand what was missing. That, you know, was there a whole lot of stuff missing, or just, you know, that hard piece of data that says employee A was making $100 a week, their share of the pension plan was $5, and the employer was $5. That was missing for a period of so many years or whatever. What hard data was missing for you?
Specifically, what we were unable to verify was the salary level in those last 5 years. So, there was lots of information in the files that were available. There was information on, you know, as I say, the some of the key components. So that would be the start date, the end date, the date of birth, and but the information that was key to calculating the actual pension benefit would be the 5 years of salary, and that just, pardon me, wasn't present in the majority of files that they were able to locate for us, and certainly, obviously, not available in those files that they couldn't locate for us.
And I know it's not your job to give an opinion on this. I want to ask it, but it seems strange that, you know, anybody that's been around pensions at all realize that, you know, especially with defined benefit programs, and as the vast majority of government plans are, that very real component would be missing. You know, I was kind of, this was going through my head when you were answering some of the questions, was, well, what's missing? Because I could say, you know, like somebody, well, we could argue about a start date, right? We may have thought they were hired on you know, the 10th, and they were actually hired on the 12th or something like that, or you know, like 1970 as opposed to 1972. But you're telling me that the crucial data that a lot of people would use, especially as it relates to a DB plan, which again, these are most, that was what, and I'm going to put words in your mouth, but is that what alarmed you the most, was that piece of data that was missing, was the ability for them, the kind of aha moment that says, you know, this is where you should be at on the pension plan. Appreciate that it swings both ways, like that some pensioners may get less and some may get more. So there's certain people that may have said, just kind of walked away and said, I'm not going to bring any light to this. So, but on exiting, most employers, as Mr. Porter would say, not so much a workshop, but I'm certainly that you would be handed a sheet of paper and showing that this is, you know, this is your years of employment and this is what you can expect for your pension plan. So I want to make sure what you're talking about here then is that missing piece, and not only in the superannuates, but those that are of other government jurisdictions like DHAs and so forth, and is the teacher's pension in this also?
We don't have access to the teacher's plan.
Okay. So you don't have to access the teacher's plan. But so it's DHAs and maybe some other government entities. So the large concern here, if you want to, and I don't want to again put words in your mouth, but the fact is, if you're prioritize them 1 to 10, and 1 being the highest, this would be that lack of information for the 5-year averaging.
Well, certainly that was the deficiency we found, was that the salary information wasn't available, and I guess along with that, I mean, both the Public Service Commission and Capital Health have fairly recent record retention policies, and I know they have been sort of revised over the years. What we found, though, was that because those files were absent, that it was clear that regardless of how robust those retention policies were, they weren't necessarily being followed. The other thing is that, you know, that there are different processes for salary determination, as I understand it, for both, you know, sort of union and non-union employees, and the information that might be included in a file under those circumstances would be different. But just generally speaking, regardless of whether union or non-union, the information just wasn't there for us to verify. In some files that we found, I recall, or I believe that there was like an electronic printout of the payroll system, if you will, that would indicate what had been paid, but the underlying support for that number wasn't there. So unless we or somebody in government knew that that number was in fact the accurate number, again, all you're going by is a computer printout as being your source information for the pension benefit, and we suggest that regardless of whether you're doing your pension electronically, as most places are, of course, that the underlying records to support those 5 years of salary need to be in there. They don't necessarily have to be kept in paper format, but they need to be somewhere so that you can verify the pension benefit.
Okay. Would you say, if you don't feel that you're, you know, that you could offer an opinion on it, I'm not looking for something outside your jurisdiction, but is it fair to say that since the Public Service Commission in the last number of years have taken that responsibility, especially as it relates to HR management in-house, makes it a little bit neater to handle as opposed to having various departments accountable for those functions, that you would bring it under one roof, if you will, that may have been the cause of some of the one with internally as it relates to the superannuates, that, you know, you had, you know, you may have had a human resource department, so on, in natural resources, and another one over in finance, and when you bring them all, will that help you or help us control those, or should that help us control that aspect of looking after where we're at, especially with the 5-year exiting term?
Well, certainly having responsibility for retirees' files all within the Public Service Commission should reduce the risk of missing information. As we were going through the audit, that was one of the reasons we were told why potentially information wasn't available was because it was at a departmental level and either didn't get sent to the Public Service Commission or, you know, there was on retirement, so there was a breakdown. But certainly the Public Service Commission's policy is that all retirees come to them and that they then are responsible under the file retention schedule for maintaining those files as they need to be maintained in accordance with their policy.
Okay, and my last question regarding pensions is, and I know we had talked about the teacher's pension plan, and do you feel that, and please say, if you again say, I mean, you take the fifth on it or whatever, do you feel that that's proper that that the Auditor General's department does not have the ability to audit the teacher's pension plan?
Well, I guess from our perspective, I think the main thing is that it is subject to audit. I mean, you know, as auditors, I guess we're all subject to the same professional standards. And you know, the recommendation that we made to the Public Service Superannuation Plan was directed towards their new governance structure and their new board. I really can't comment on whether the teachers has conducted performance audits. So that board has looked to have external performance audits performed. I guess the main thing is that that there be the ability or the will on the part of the governing body to undertake and have those audits done independently and reported back to the board. Again, aside from what management might do, because management has some good processes, but to look at issues like we did, such as investment selection and investment management.
I appreciate your candor on it, but in your professional courtesy to other auditors, but I guess I ask that question from the perspective of you're the auditors responsible for the public purse. And that's why I ask the question of you. If that was the case, and no disrespect meant, but we don't need the Auditor General's office. We'll just bring in Deloitte or somebody to audit us as a get-go. You know, so the fact is you're comfortable then with or anybody can certainly answer this. That the teacher's pension plan is being audited properly, and there's no need for the Auditor General to be involved. The external look is fine.
Well, as I say, I know that there's an annual financial statement audit of the teacher's plan. I'm not aware of whether there have been additional non-financial audits conducted at this point in time. The Auditor General's office, we conduct, of course, the public accounts audit, but there are many entities within, in fact, the vast majority of entities within the government reporting entity, so agencies, boards, and commissions are not audited by our office, so it's fairly usual, and that's, of course, in many jurisdictions that is the case, that the audit office conducts certain audits but not all audits. So the fact that the teachers is not subject to audit by this office, I guess our main concern is that it's audited by somebody, and I guess, you know, it would be, I guess, hopeful that the recommendation that we made to the Public Service Superannuation Plan was perhaps embraced as well by the governing board of the teachers' plan to have, if they haven't already, have external audits covered on such things as investment performance and investment management.
Thank you. That's enough.
Thank you, Mr. Corbett. And for the final round to the Liberal Caucus, Mr. Rankin.
I have no further questions on this.
Are there any further questions from any of the other members? Mr. McGuire?
I'll just make it quick. So in your view, how can the relationship between your office, the Department of Finance, and the Treasury Board improve? If you had a magic wand.
Oh.
Well, I'm hesitating because I think we actually have an excellent working relationship. We deal with them, you know, all the time. We have, you know, we have differences of opinion on various matters. But at the end of the day, you know, sort of we either work through them or sort of we agree to disagree. There will always be that in a professional environment. But, you know, we certainly respect their work. We believe they respect our work. And we have a very cordial and good working relationship with, now, we've dealt mostly with the Department of Finance, of course, as they were before. Treasury Board we've dealt with on some, you know, various matters, and there's been no issue there from a financial audit perspective. So on a go forward, I guess I'm hoping for and anticipate that good relationship to continue.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Goff.
I just have one final question. It's have a question on the 2013 budget revenue projections. Acknowledging that the projections have to be based on reasonable assumptions, I'm wondering if your office has any information on how these projections fared in the current fiscal year.
So just to clarify, this is the 2013-14 budget that you're speaking about?
And 13, how, yes.
So, and how it transpired as that year, as this
yeah,
year has progressed?
Where we sit.
So we don't continually audit this as it happens. And I guess the only information that we have on those assumptions that were used and how they have come to be during the current year is the same information that you would have, which was included in the forecast update of December 19th. So I think in that it indicated why there were adjustments to certain tax revenues and there were some prior year adjustments. And that was based on some, you know, I think in the case of the tax revenue, it had personal income taxes had to do with the tax yield was not as great as was anticipated. So that's for every dollar, how much tax will be generated. That's what the tax yield is. And then on the HST side, there was, I think, a change in the a downward estimate of the growth rate in household income available for consumption, which would generate HST revenue. So, but in terms of our involvement with that, we will be looking at how those 13-14 assumptions feed into the 14-15 mm-hmm. assumptions when we do our work on the revenue estimates over the next few months. We haven't started the process yet, but we'll look to see what has transpired and how that will influence what they estimate will transpire.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Rankin?
Yeah, I just wanted to make one final comment. I'd just like to thank the Auditor General Office for coming here today and for responding so promptly and all the important work, and a special thanks to Mr. LaPointe.
Thank you, Mr. Rankin. And if there's no further questions, we will allow the Acting Auditor General, Mr. Horgan, to provide us with some closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In conclusion, I just simply want to express our appreciation for the interest that this committee has on the work that we do and for inviting us here this morning to answer questions. It's always a pleasure to serve the information needs of this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Horgan. We will now take a short, very short recess, and we will continue with some further briefing. So we'll take a short recess now. Thank you.